On this edition of the Scott Radley Show podcast, we are talking about inflation, we are talking about the election, and we are talking about old musicians and whether they should hang it up before they get too creaky to rock and roll anymore. Stick around.
Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
We are all very attentive, attuned these days to what's going on in the world of money because we see inflation rising and things are costing more. You go fill up your tank, you go buy bananas, you do whatever. It's costing us more. Inflation is biting all of us. And so the Bank of Canada is trying to do what it can to slow things down that way. So today the benchmark interest rate was raised by half a point up to 1.5%, which is just below where it was when the pandemic started. It was 1.75% then. It was lowered a few times to stimulate the economy. Here we are now. I want to bring in Marvin Ryder from the DeGroote School of Business, the man we turn to for explanations on these things. Marvin, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
So, okay, I think most people now understand why you would raise interest rates now to cool things off a little, to slow down some stuff, to try and keep the inflation under control. I'm going to ask you two things, and you can answer them both together, or you can wait for me to ask you again the second time. But what is the best case scenario that comes from this increase today, and what's the worst case scenario that comes from it?
Well, we'll start with the worst case first, if you don't mind. Obviously, that these interest rate increases are not going to do anything. And why is that the worst case scenario is that we're not completely sure what's causing all of this inflation. Some of it is coming from post-COVID demand. In other words, as COVID has gone away, you and I started buying, and we were buying at a pace higher than businesses could supply. So when you have more demand and not enough supply, that puts pressure on. But also some of this inflation is coming from the uncertainty caused by the Ukraine-Russian conflict. That specifically, for instance, is what's influencing gasoline prices. World oil prices have gone from roughly $60 a barrel at Christmas time to $115 a barrel. They've nearly doubled in a few months. Why is that? Russia, most people don't realize this, but Russia is the third largest producer of oil in the world behind the United States and Saudi Arabia. And if the world says, look, to punish Russia, we're not going to buy Russian oil, then the rest of the world is fighting for the oil that remains. Again, more demand, not necessarily more supply, causes the price to go up. Now, we're in the summertime. This is a great time, and I know that we're not buying as much fuel, we're not buying as much heating, and so the world's nations are working hard to see if they can figure out a way to fill the void of the Russian oil and natural gas this summer so that when we get back to colder temperatures this fall, things will be fine. Part of that means that OPEC's going to have to start pumping some more oil. OPEC is quite enjoying oil prices at $115 a barrel and doesn't seem to be that interested in turning on the taps to bring the price down to, let's say, $80 a barrel, $70 a barrel. So there's a big diplomatic challenge on that front, and that's the worst-case scenario. By increasing interest rates, they cause you and I to think twice before borrowing. Now, we're not going to borrow any money to buy a cup of coffee. We're not going to borrow any money to have lunch at our favorite restaurant. But if you're thinking about buying a new car or buying a boat or putting an addition onto the house or, you know, finishing the basement, it's gotten more expensive. And their hope is that some people would say, I'm just going to wait a little while before doing this. And if I can just get demand to calm down, things would be better. So the worst case scenario is it doesn't improve. Now, the best case scenario is it's like putting the brakes on in the car that will start to slow inflation. And they've said in their announcement today that first, inflation is their number one job and they aren't planning to let up on the brake until inflation starts to come down. But the other thing that we know is that it doesn't happen immediately. So I increase interest rates today, it doesn't mean inflation goes down tomorrow. It takes a couple or 3 months for these actions to appear in the general economy. And so the hope is to get inflation under control in the second half of the year. This is June 1st. We're still in the first half of the year. But maybe by, you know, August, September, we might see inflation rates start to come down more into the range of, let's say, 3% rather than 6.8%, and that would be getting us in the right direction. Finally, and I'll give this back to you, what's the other fear? Well, you want to put the brake on the economy and you want to cool the economy a bit, but you don't want to freeze the economy. And this is why, you know, in July, this is when they're going to revisit this. I won't be shocked if they increase interest rates another quarter of a point. I probably won't be shocked if they do it another half a point, but then I think they're going to pause to say, okay, we've done a lot of stuff here now to try to correct this. Let's just make sure we aren't cooling too much and head us into this, and I hate to say this word out loud, head us into a recession come the fall. And because there is this uncertainty with Russia and Ukraine, there's also uncertainty with COVID. You know, as much as we're all happy, the pandemic has not been declared over. We're still in a pandemic, and God knows, I hate to say this out loud too, but COVID could come back in some way come this fall. So, you know, given all of this uncertainty, they're trying to walk a very fine line.
And they have said, by the way, and you know this, just for the people listening, they have said that there will be more increases coming. So they're warning us ahead of time exactly what you just said. The balancing act here, in addition to what you just described about you want to cool the economy but not seize it or cause the engine to seize, is there's also two sides of the there's two groups of people. There are those who, Marvin, want inflation to go down, everyone pretty much, because everything costs so darn much, so you raise the rates. But there are also an awful lot of people who owe money, who have debt, and every time you do this, interest rates go up. So you're saving money on one hand, but you're then ending up paying more on the other hand. It's a real delicate balancing act.
Well, it is. Now, let me just speak to those people who bought property in the last couple of years. When you got your mortgage, you were, we use the term, stress tested, not at the rate the bank was going to give you, but at 5.25%. And I actually believe now the stress test has gone up to 6.25% because of these interest rate hikes. Now, what was this stress testing all about? What the bank wanted to make sure and wanted you to understand was that if interest rates went up to as high as 5.25% or now 6.25%, that you could still carry your debt and comfortably manage it. If you couldn't manage it at that level, then you weren't going to get your mortgage, or at least you weren't going to get a mortgage for the full amount that you wanted. So, yes, interest rates have gone up to 1.5%. This is their rate, their internal rate. That means mortgages are going to be in the 3-4% range. That's still well below the stress test level. Now, yes, again, I understand. You know, if you have a variable rate mortgage, what it means, not that you're going to pay more on your mortgage, but the amount of interest embedded in your payment goes up. The amount of principal reduction embedded in your payment goes down a little bit. So that means you're going to be in debt a little bit longer. But the theory is that these rate increases are still relatively minor, and you are able to manage it, or else you wouldn't have got the mortgage in the first place. And I don't think anyone feels that the 5.25% interest rate or the 6.25% interest rate, that's not even in the field of possibility at this point. I think when the Bank of Canada says they are prepared to do whatever it takes, yes, I could see their trend-setting rate getting to 2%, even 2.5%, maybe even 2.75%. But I don't think it's going to get much beyond that, so that in terms of your borrowing cost, in the worst-case scenario, you get back to the historical average. And you know, I don't mean to sound like I'm not taking this seriously, but when I bought my first house, I've only had two, but when I bought my first house in 1987, my interest rate, and it was a special deal from CIBC, was 11.25%. So when somebody's looking at a mortgage at 3.5%, or maybe 4%, or 4.5%, you know, I say, cry me a river, buddy. I had to handle it at 11.25%. So I think our problem is that we have very short memories, and we don't remember what the world was like before COVID. We somehow convinced ourselves that these really, really low interest rates were the new normal, when I've always tried to say these are simply temporary to get us through the pandemic. Those people who didn't quite understand all of that, yes, they have a right to be a little bit afraid.
And we only have 30 seconds, but I was also thinking, I mean, we just went through COVID where a lot of businesses to stay afloat had to take loans. And that, even more than mortgages, I'm looking at them saying, all right, now that things are just starting to get better, they have to pay off these loans. They're not mortgages. They're the ones, I think, who are really going to feel this right now.
Some of them. Again, it depends upon which programs they use. The government had a number of programs around giving them loans, and the idea was that if you attempted to pay it off on time, you would actually get a certain amount of debt forgiveness or interest forgiveness as it went. If you took advantage of those programs, I think you're going to be fine. again, if you finance it in other ways, take a look at it. And the first thing I would tell anybody, whether it's a business or a citizen at large, have this conversation with your banker. Sit down. Banks do not want to foreclose and own your house. Banks do not want to drive a business out of operation. But you need to talk to them as soon as you think something might be amiss, because that gives them more degrees of freedom. If you paint things into a corner and don't have that conversation and then wait until it blows up, sometimes there's nothing that can be done for you. So don't treat the bank as an enemy. It can be your friend during these difficult times, but you've got to have that conversation sooner rather than later.
Economics professors can also be our friends. And I appreciate you doing this. Thank you, as always, for coming on.
Glad to be with you.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
The election is tomorrow. And, you know, we'd love to say it's not enemies. We just have different points of view. I think some people see the other side, whatever the other side is, as the enemy. Would anyone disagree? We all agree with that, right? Not necessarily. We don't love that, but I think we probably agree that it's politics has become much more of a blood sport than it was at any time previously, at least over the last little while. However, this election, this provincial election, I still think there are people that feel very strongly, but boy, it seems like it has not got the traction that some other elections recently have for whatever reason in the public consciousness. Let me bring in Michael Tobe. He is a columnist for Troy Media and Looney Politics, a contributor to the National Post and the Washington Times, and was a speechwriter for former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Love having him on the show. Michael, how are you tonight?
I'm good, Scott. How are you?
Excellent, thank you. Thanks for doing this. Why do you think, maybe you disagree with my premise, but it seems to me that somehow this election just hasn't seemed to grab a lot of traction in people's consciousness, and I'm wondering why. First of all, do you agree? And second of all, if so, or if not, why not, or why so?
Yeah, I would agree in the sense that it seems like a foregone conclusion, and it has seemed like that now almost literally since the campaign started. I think part of it is because many Ontarians, based on the polling data that we see and the projections that we're reading, seem quite content with Ontario Premier Doug Ford and the PC government. We recognize that obviously Mr. Ford and his government have made mistakes. You know, things have not been handled perfectly during the coronavirus pandemic or COVID-19. But by and large, he has provided good leadership. He has listened to medical authorities, worked well with them, plus as well, including you know, columns I've written for the National Post and others have suggested as well, Doug Ford has gone through what I called last week a metamorphosis, in the sense that we're now seeing the Doug Ford that I remember meeting many years ago in his late father's legislative office in the Ontario legislature. His late father, Doug Ford Sr., who's a businessman, also served a term as an MPP under then Premier Mike Harris. So I met Doug Ford and I met his late brother, Rob Ford, who, as many of your listeners know, was the former mayor of Toronto. Both of them were very good people, very nice people, but the Doug Ford that I saw years ago is now the Doug Ford that I've seen today. The friendly, affable, confident leader, a person who is willing to listen to others, work with others, and build relationships, even with people who are diametrically opposed to him, including Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland. You know, the relationship or the working relationship between Ford and Freeland has been written about quite a lot, where they relied on each other quite extensively during COVID-19, even though obviously ideologically they look at things very, very differently. So I think that Ford, using sort of his Ford Nation philosophy, which is a combination of populist ideas or rhetoric, if you like, along with small C conservative principles, has bounced out and created, I believe, a very strong platform and a very confident type of leadership style that many Ontarians are pleased with. And the proof will be in the pudding tomorrow, but based on the fact that every major polling company seems to show that the Conservatives are ahead by 7 to 10 points, which historically in Ontario, Scott, means that it will be a majority government, or for Mr. Ford, a second straight majority government, it appears as if the reason that this campaign has not been, you know, very interesting, very aggressive, or very straightforward, if you will, is because many Ontarians, the majority of them, seem quite content with Doug Ford's leadership.
you know, in politics, contentment might then lead to malaise. And I think you're absolutely right about that. If we're fine, then, you know, why get too worked up? But the other leaders surely have been looking for some way to get in there and find a weakness. I've just been surprised that there's been no or very little success from them in that happening, in finding that weak spot.
Well, I mean, that goes then back to the leadership as well. That, you know, that is something that Andrea Horvath, and who's the NDP leader, and Stephen Del Duca, the Liberal leader, will have to deal with possibly as of tomorrow, depending on, one, what the election turnout is, two, what the election results are, and three, how their parties, their respective parties, fare. Certainly, they've tried to punch holes, so to speak, in Doug Ford's election platform. They tried to attack the progressive conservatives. They tried to go after the government. But I think it's fair to say, and whether people like it or not, and whether Ontarians like it or not, as I said, the proof is in the pudding. Thus far, there is no proof whatsoever that any of their attacks, critiques, criticisms, alternative policies, you know, different sorts of things that they've announced, nothing seems to have worked. And again, it goes back to the top. It goes back to leadership. And sure, they can blame the teams around them that they didn't give them, you know, good enough ideas, strong enough support, move the parties in the right direction, or even just move the campaign in the right direction. But, you know, the buck stops somewhere, and typically it stops with the leader. So Horvath and Del Duca will have to deal with this pretty soon, especially if everything that the polling companies are showing right now, Scott, is valid.
Michael, I don't perceive that this election has been unusually or even really nasty. It's been
no.
You know, as political, you know, campaigns go, pretty civil. And I look at this and I think, you know, we say we want civil politics, and we might even think we mean it when we say we want civil politics. But I wonder if some of the politicos who are going to do the postmortem on this afterwards say, you know, that just, for whatever reason, doesn't seem to grab people's attention as much as going negative and putting out nasty ads and going down, you know, into the mud and everything else. I wonder if at the end of this, some of the people who study this are going to say, look, civil is lovely, but we just showed that it doesn't necessarily work as well as the other stuff.
Well, you can criticize it on one sense, but then again, there's many people that have been very critical of the current Conservative Party of Canada leadership race, which has actually been the polar opposite to what we've seen in Ontario.
True.
And people have been heavily critical of Pierre Poilievre, Jean Charest, Patrick Brown, Leslie Lewis, and the others for running what they feel is a volatile campaign. You know, it's fine to be betwixt and between yourself, but you have to pick one side or the other. And you can't say, well, this is no good, I want the alternative, and then look at the alternative and say, it's no good, I want the one I rejected initially. In the end, you ultimately have to choose whether you want to have and believe in a more civil campaign or a more lively and, shall we say, volatile affair, which is what the Conservative leadership race has been like. So there's no happy medium. There's no middle ground.
There really isn't.
You have to go one way or the other.
There really isn't. Now, the polls, and you're absolutely right, every poll that I've seen anyway seems to show the Conservatives either at a majority or very close to majority. We don't know yet. If that doesn't happen, I think we will all fall off our chairs if the Conservatives don't win the election. It's a question of how much. If they don't get a majority, could you see a situation where the NDP and Liberals align and try to govern?
I mean, the situation could certainly exist, and it obviously has happened in various provinces, including our province in Ontario, and it's also happened federally, too. They have come out, both the leader of the NDP and the leader of the Liberals, and said that they would not consider something like this, that if Doug Ford does win the election but does not form a majority, they wouldn't immediately form a coalition government to bring him down. But on the other hand, the temptation always exists. It exists for every politician. And the possibility of leadership, depending on who comes ahead, whether it's Andrea Horvath as official opposition a second time, or whether Stephen Del Duca can somehow bring the Liberals back from literally from the dead and bring them into the official opposition position, it would be hard to believe that they wouldn't consider it. It would be hard to believe they wouldn't discuss it. And it would be hard to believe they wouldn't have a plan B ready just in case something were to happen. So right now, publicly, they're saying no, because there's not
really
a great You have to, because there's not really a great affinity or great flavor for it, because a lot of people, especially nowadays, look at politics and believe that whoever wins the election should at least have the chance to form government or, if nothing else, prove that a minority government situation could work, much like Stephen Harper did in two of his three governments, my old friend and boss, and much like Justin Trudeau has been doing two of the last three times, although now he now has a formal coalition or working agreement in place with the federal NDP until 2025, which makes it a bit different. So I think they would probably allow Doug Ford to carry on as premier. They would probably allow him to introduce his first budget. But it wouldn't shock me at that point if the PCs somehow didn't end up with a majority, at least in terms of number of seats. It would surprise me that the NDP and the Liberals wouldn't have a plan behind the scenes ready to go when Doug Ford announces his first budget, it's brought forward, and they defeat in the Ontario legislature and then form a coalition before, yeah, obviously have to, you know, drop the writ, so to speak, and move forward with another election.
Michael Taube, always love having you on. I know you're busy these days with lots of demands. We appreciate you taking a few minutes. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Take care.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
KISS. Some of you would be members of the KISS Army. Some of you listening right now may be wearing Gene Simmons makeup. Unlikely, but you know, you never know. But some of you may say, no, I have no interest in this idiotic band. Couldn't care less about them. Well, hang with me for a minute here, because we're not going to be playing a bunch of KISS music, and we're not talking about the greatest moments of KISS's career or any of that stuff. That's not what this is about. It's about an interview that Gene Simmons, the aforementioned Gene Simmons, did a couple days ago, talking about where KISS is right now and what they're doing and where they're going. And they have announced that they are on their farewell tour. And he says, when this is done, we are done. Period. End of story. No more. Now, I know we've heard this before. I think The Who has had 15 farewell tours. Elton John, I believe, is on year number 7 of his farewell tour. Cher has done millions of farewell tours. I mean, I know that we hear this all the time, but you know, KISS is one of those bands. They don't, you wouldn't think so. You wouldn't think this of them if you see them, but they, no drinking, no drugs, no smoking, a lot of sex, but this is a band that has been pretty businesslike as far as what they've done with their careers. And they say, once this tour is done, we are over. And the reason is, we don't think that people want to see a bunch of old men on stage, either tripping and falling in our costumes or not able to perform the way we did once upon a time. Kind of makes sense, doesn't it? Let me bring in Eric Alper. He is a music publicist. He's a music writer. He is a commentator on the industry, does all those kinds of things. Eric, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, listen, I'm good. I'm glad we're, you know, I'm glad we're in a June, and I'm glad we're talking about this stuff, because this, to me, whether or not they follow through with this, and if there's a band that might, it might be them. This seems to me like the way it should be. Get to a certain point where you say, we can't be what we were once upon a time. Let's let people remember us as we were at our best. See you later.
I absolutely agree with you. The people, and you said it at the top of the segment, you know, even if you're not a fan of KISS, the ability to take a look at them from a purely aesthetic or business sense, that Gene Simmons has essentially solidified his history in business by saying no. And that's really interesting to me, because like you said, The Who have gone out on tour many, many, many times, selling millions of dollars worth of merchandise and concert tickets. Cher has done the same. Elton John is 6 years and counting, with another three more to go. But the entrepreneurship of a band like that, the ability to have the self-confidence to say, we are getting old, we're still amazing live, so come and see us. But to have that level of self-confidence, an almost delusional self of self-confidence that you need not only to be a rock star, but a rock star in your daily life and business. It's pretty amazing. You know, the fact that they can actually say, we are really, really great, but we don't want to do that. We don't want to fool the fans. We don't want to take risks and fall down on her face and ruin our legacy and the legend. This is why you see teenagers for the next 50 years wearing Ramones t-shirts, because it's almost like they quit before they got bad. They quit before they got old. And it's a really good lesson for people.
Well, I mean, leaving aside, and we'll get back to this in a second, whether for fans and that kind of thing, artistically, it's good. One thing I've never understood is there's kind of this expectation almost that art, that musicians and artists are going to keep going forever. Why are musicians and artists not entitled to retire like a doctor or a nurse or an accountant?
I think it's mostly because the artists themselves are so ego-driven and so bored when they're at home for the most part that they just can't say no to going out on the road. And it's having 30 people on your payroll, from your manager to your business manager to accountants to supervisors and assistants, that rely on you to keep making that money, having it rolled in so that everybody else surrounding you can keep their jobs, whether you're a guitar tech or whether you're a drum technician or a roadie, or just on the day-to-day level of keeping a business. So part of it is that they're not allowed to retire because there's so many people around you that don't want you to retire. And I think the other part is that the Rolling Stones did something absolutely remarkable, is that they kept changing the rules on expectations of where we thought bands, especially rock bands, can play. Because we would never tell B.B. King or a blues man or a blues woman to stop. Nobody would ever tell Bonnie Raitt, don't you think it's time to hang up? No, you kind of expect that. But for rock and roll, nobody was able to do what the Rolling Stones have done the last 60, 65 years. And so they're the new gold medal of standard, where artists are kind of like, well, if they're going out on the road, maybe we should too. Why should we leave money on the table? So a lot of people justify that the artists just don't want anybody else to take their spotlight. It's what they do.
Maybe. I'll tell you one of the saddest things, and like, I'm a fan. I like Johnny Cash. I like Johnny Cash's music. One of the saddest things that you can find on YouTube anywhere was his last performance. He'd had a series of strokes. He couldn't walk. He was in some senior's home somewhere. They plopped him in a chair and put a mic in front of him, and he still sang a couple of his songs. But I'm looking going, let the man just age and be able to just not always be still performing. Now, maybe he loved it. Maybe I'm whiffing on this one, because maybe this was the highlight of his year, to be able to still perform.
Yeah, maybe.
But somehow I hate to use the word pathetic, but it kind of was.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple of bands that I've seen in the last 5 or 6 years that I grew up, and I have absolutely clear memories of not only buying their albums when they were first around, but seeing them in their prime. And it's really sad when you see them now, because not only do you feel bad for them, but it's also a sign that you're aging too. You're not the young 30 or 15-year-old that you once were. And so when I looked around at one of these specific shows that I was at, with a band that I dearly love, it made me very sad knowing that I'm still the youngest person here and I'm 50, you know? And so it was that constant reminder that we're all getting old too.
Yeah. And you know what? I mean, look, we mock or we criticize old boxing. For some reason, boxing seems to be the thing that we always come back to, of guys who come back and stay too long and don't get out of the game. And maybe that's because, you know, I mean, if you're a boxer, you're having physical harm done to your brain if you take punches. We saw Muhammad Ali sticking around too long and others. So that's an example. But, you know, to watch a musician who, as you say, was at the top of their game and just great, and now basically their voice is not the same and it's a little warbly, and I don't know. It's almost like they need someone to say, hey, it's time. Right. It's okay. If you leave, we still love you. Your canon of music is there. You've got $100 million in the bank. I'm sure you're going to be okay. Thanks. But nobody does that.
Nobody does that. Yeah, and it's hard. You know, I can't picture Nine Inch Nails, for instance, going off being angry in their 60s. But then, you know, nobody thought that the Rolling Stones would be doing it in their 60s and 70s. And it's a little bit tiring, you know, kind of making fun of that band. But I wonder if part of it is just really does come down to they just don't know what else to do with their lives. You know, and you brought up the sports analogy, and it's a really good one. You know, we see it in all sports, in baseball and hockey, where somebody is not Gordie Howe coming back at 51 playing in the NHL against the 19-year-old Wayne Gretzky. You know, there are people that lose the step in step. And when you're a band, you know, the big difference, I think, between musicians and just regular people in business is that business tends to not move so quick these days. But musicians, if you're Kiss and some 17-year-old hotshot assistant tells you you've got to go on TikTok and start making 15-second videos, they're going to say, I have no idea what you just said. You know, they can't even, they might not be even be able to comprehend where the new fans are going to be coming from. And maybe Kiss has said, look, we can only go so far. We need to let the others do it, which is what ABBA did a couple of weeks ago.
See, thank you.
About this before.
Yes, we just talked about that on the show this week about ABBA. And look, whether you love ABBA or hate ABBA, we're talking about, I mean, Kiss and ABBA may be at the furthest end of the spectrum from each other, yeah. Although, you know, costumes and, you know, all that showmanship, maybe they're not that far apart, really. But anyway, they, you know, when you say that these bands don't know what to do with themselves, ABBA has resisted huge money offers to perform live again, and yet they've still found a way to remain relevant and keep their music around with stage, with Broadway shows, and now with this new show in London. It is possible to take what you've done and package it and be creative with it. They've shown this. If you're in Kiss, you don't necessarily have to be on stage. You could still potentially find ways to keep your music front and center and keep making money at it.
Yeah, and the answer is how much money is too much? And who's really, really great at business? You know, for all the time that we can talk about ABBA doing, you know, virtual concerts with holograms and what they're doing kind of now using like virtual reality technology that they don't even have to go out on tour. And they really haven't gone out on tour since probably 1980, 81. And they've turned down somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion back then, which is probably worth about $4 billion now with inflation. But for all those artists that we can say they turned it down, they turned it down, they turned it down, and they got on Broadway, there's thousands who had to retire and who never got their shot. So part of it is like business, where why does one restaurant get to succeed over another one that's selling the exact same style of food? And it's having the right people around you. It's having just the right vibe and the right image and everything, and a lot of luck and a lot of people saying yes to you that you don't even know about. Those are the really successful ones that just manage to keep saying yes for all the right reasons. But look at ABBA. They said no for 50 years, and they're still probably making more money because people know that it's the albums and it's the songs. With Kiss, I'm not so sure it's the music. It's really about the image and the craft.
It's the show, yeah. And how different might, and we don't know the answer to this, this is entirely hypothetical, how different might we have seen the Beatles if before John Lennon was killed, with all the requests for them to get back together, they did and weren't quite as good as we remember for some reason?
Oh, I'll go much further. Yeah, I mean, how big would Queen be if Freddie Mercury doesn't pass away? You know,
and by
the way that he did, you know, with having AIDS at the time when it was still a really nasty word to say in the media and in whispered corners, the fact that we are now able to accept what happened in the 80s and 90s puts a little bit more of a halo around somebody like Freddie Mercury because of what he went through. And because they can't tour with him, it makes all the things that we see on YouTube that much better because we are never going to see that again.
You mentioned Freddie Mercury. Funny you did that because let's bring this right around. It's a great segue because the other day I'm down in the basement. I'm doing some work late at night and I have a screen beside me and I had some YouTube videos going and it was one of these rabbit holes that you end up in. You and I have talked about this before. And I start watching videos from Live Aid, 1984, summer, July 1984. Of course, Freddie Mercury's greatest moment, the basis of Bohemian Rhapsody, the movie. And it's amazing to me as we're talking about this topic. That's 40 years ago, almost. 40 years ago, almost not all, but almost every one of those bands is still going. That yeah. played almost everyone, unless someone's died, and maybe some of them have been replaced, like Queen. But if your guys are alive or your women are alive, they're for the most part still going 40 years later. No one quits.
Yeah, you look at Madonna and Duran Duran and Thompson Twins and Paul McCartney is still on tour. He is worth a quadrillion dollars. He didn't have to go and do this, but he loves this. He still wants, when he sees the Rolling Stones out on tour, I bet you there is still something inside him, or Elton John on tour, something inside him is saying, oh, so, you know, Billy Joel's playing, you know, 15 nights straight at Madison Square Garden. Dude, book me 40 nights. Like, that's the competitive spirit. I'm going to write the best song. I'm going to have the best album. I'm going to have the most screams by anybody. It's still in them. They still want to find that perfect song. But yeah, that's a really interesting point about Live Aid, especially because I don't think anybody would have thought those artists were sticking around.
We've got a terrible connection all of a sudden, but let me just throw one more thing at you, and then we'll hopefully can keep it going for just a little while longer. And that is, watching those Live Aid videos, one of the things that blew me away was they had a nod to some of the early acts or early-ish acts to rock on that lineup. If people remember, they had the Beach Boys, they had Paul McCartney, as you say. There were a few others that they had that were like earlier, not necessarily at their biggest moment in the 80s, but, you know, a nod to the past. You realize that summer was only 7 years after Elvis died. If he had not died, we might have seen Elvis on the stage at Live Aid, which you can't even imagine. It seems like it's like a generation or a decades away. Elvis could have been there.
I think about this a lot where, you know, and you know, you and I should get into this another time, but it's like growing up in the 80s, you had artists that looked old and felt old, like Genesis and Moody Blues and Sting and the Police and all those Motown bands. Aretha Franklin was still having the biggest hits of their career, and they felt like veterans. And then you go back to Wikipedia and you realize Sting was only 29. You know, like, yeah. Or Dire Straits was only 31, like in Mark Knopfler. Like, how at the peak of their careers, they're still going and they're still performing. It's really amazing that all these bands from the 60s and 70s were only a couple of years away from starting their bands, and they were already megastars that we're still talking about them today. I don't think that's going to happen again.
No, like you think, okay, now, I mean, you know, the Beatles were a long, long time ago, but 1984, the Beatles weren't that far away from when they were still, they weren't, it wasn't that long.
They weren't even on CD yet.
Well.
Yeah. Wow.
It is wild. If you go back and watch some of the Live Aid stuff, and you realize every one of them is pretty much is still going, and I don't know how. And whether you agree or disagree with Gene Simmons and Kiss, that, you know what, when you get to a certain age, it is just time, so you don't ruin your reputation. Time to take a pass and wave goodbye. We'll see. Eric, before we let you go, do you believe Gene Simmons, though, or not? Do you believe that in 5 years that they will have stuck to this, or do you think we'll be seeing the Gene Simmons reunion tour or the Kiss reunion tour?
I know for a fact that they are done. I actually talked to both Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons this year about this very topic, and they are absolutely done. Yeah, this is it. This is it.
There you go. From the man who talked to the man, see? Eric Alper, always appreciate the time. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me, Bill. We'll talk soon.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
I'm not just a pawn in this game.
Three nights a week on Global.
They're putting targets on their back. Massive.
drama.
I guess you could say I'm in a showman. They're just so in love and so annoying. Enough.
Betrayal.
The guy just put up his best friend now.
And plot twists.
What is happening right now?
You'll never see coming.
If you're coming for me,
this is perfect.
I'm coming for you then.
It'll be a battle.
Like, it'll be war.
Big Brother Canada. All new Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Sundays on Global. Stream on Stack TV.